Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Anybody who follows Division I football and basketball knows the drill. A coach who has promised all the young men he recruited that he isn't going anywhere goes somewhere. Shortly thereafter, it becomes apparent that the coach has left behind a mess. Maybe it's a team dependent on a player who didn't take his own SATs. Maybe it's a program supported by boosters who've given the players cars, money, and jobs they could mysteriously do from their dorm rooms or the gym. Maybe the coach has suggested to some of the professors with whom the players are allegedly studying that it would be a shame if anything were to happen to their nice offices. News of corruption in college sports is no shock, but in Varsity Green, subtitled A Behind-the-Scenes Look at Culture and Corruption in College Athletics, Mark Yost has made some important and even surprising points about the landscape of the bowl games and the NCAA basketball tournament. When we had the opportunity to discuss the subject this week, I began the conversation by citing a line from the book, "College athletics has been corrupt since the day it was born." I asked Mark Yost what specific evidence had led him to that conclusion.
Well, the first ever intercollegiate athletic event is, or was, a rowing competition between Harvard and Yale on Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. But like much of college sports today, it was not about the rowing competition, but about money. And the event was actually put on by the guy who ran the New England and Montreal Railroad. And it was designed to increase ridership on the railroad. And so rather than have it on the Charles River, where you know there's lots of sculling today, they had it on Lake Winnipesaukee. And the players got Tiffany-encrusted miniature oars and all sorts of goodie bags. And the whole idea was to increase ridership on the railroad, not to watch these guys row.
Please don't tell me, though, that the oarsmen were professionals hired by the colleges for the occasion.
No, that would come about 2 or 3 years later when they started hiring professional baseball players. Believe it or not, at places like Yale and Penn and before the Ivy League got religion, so to speak, and decided to opt out of this whole crazy game of intercollegiate athletics.
Well, let's leap forward a little bit. When you began researching more current operations, you were somewhat surprised, I gather, by how much money college football's bowl games generate and by where the cash ended up. Why?
Well, you know, these bowl games, to sort of go back a little bit, they started off as basically tourism tools. They were a means by which these communities, Pasadena, California, and Phoenix, Arizona, Miami, Florida, could lure northern people south in the winter to enjoy a little warm weather hospitality. And hopefully they would see something they liked and came back. But these have turned into big money-making businesses now, thanks to the lobbyists for the bowls. Everything is tax-deductible. They're all run as nonprofits. And the executives at some of these bowls, which pay out, the BCS championship game pays out $18.5 million, they're making six and sometimes seven figures for what's basically, it is a year-round job, but it's about a month of intensive work.
You write that, and I'm quoting here again, though a college president may be vehemently against the commercialization of college sports, he quickly realizes that he can't live without it. But haven't some college presidents decided that they can live without Division I football, for example, and in fact that their universities can't afford to live with it?
They have. The prime example, I'm coming to you from Chicago, is the University of Chicago. And there's an old joke, I think I include it in the book, that, Michigan has the Heisman Trophy and all Chicago has is the atom bomb. Because, of course, the Manhattan Project was, a lot of the brain work was done here at the University of Chicago. But a lot of college presidents realize that it would take too much political capital to fight the well-entrenched athletic department, to fight their alumni, and also to give up the media exposure that a big-time Division I football or basketball program brings to a university.
But if that sort of exposure is bringing to the campus and to the admissions office people who are coming there because they're fans of the football team or the basketball team. Is it really upgrading the university's profile?
It does two things. It obviously draws the athletic recruits, which brings the fans. A lot of alumni giving is connected to athletics, unfortunately. And in fact, the Chronicle of Higher Education has done a lot of work on this, and I cite some of their work in my book. For the longest time, academic giving far, far outpaced that of athletics. That is starting to change. Over the past 10 years, academic giving has remained relatively flat, while athletic giving has grown at about a 10 to 12% pace per year. Alumni have X amount of dollars to give, and increasingly that finite pool of money is going more to athletics than it is academics.
The NCAA has often been accused of creating hopelessly arcane rules and then of failing to adequately follow up on the regulation that they invent, but you go a long step further than that. You call the NCAA a cartel and compare it to the mafia. Was that an overstatement?
I don't think it was. I think it was a bit of artistic license to make what would have been an otherwise dry economic discussion interesting.
But yes, bringing in Tony Soprano will do that.
Well, but it, seriously, if you think about it, the facade that Tony Soprano had was these sort of front companies, these otherwise legitimate-looking businesses that masked the real business going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what the NCAA does with the facade of amateurism. They have this facade up that masks what is the real business going on here, and it's a multi-billion-dollar business that uses free labor in the form of student athletes to fill these stadiums and arenas and sell T-shirts and secure media rights. And really, I think it's a fair comparison. I mean, I'm not saying that the president of the NCAA is a gangster, but I'm saying that the two organizations use similar tactics to protect their turf.
You argue that the Division I basketball and football players recruited by the major college coaches are nothing more than the entertainment product. But don't some of these young men manage to learn something in the classroom between games, practices, supervised workouts in the gym, team meetings, and training meals?
They do, but here's my problem with the whole system, Bill, and it's this. And the media is really to blame for this, is that one of the most alarming statistics that is repeated in the book is the fact that about 3% of the kids that play high school basketball in this country get some sort of a college scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
Less than 2% of those kids ever make it to the NBA or the NFL or wherever they're headed to. But yet this system, this idea that if they dedicate themselves wholly and fully to athletics at the expense of academics, it's their way out of the inner city or their way off the farm. It's just simply statistically not true. And once the system, this money machine, is done with them, they're tossed away. They're a cog in this machine. And once that cog is no longer useful, it's thrown into the scrap heap. And that's what happens to the vast majority of these kids.
The counterargument would run, they do have an opportunity. I mean, they are on campus. Or is the responsibility they have to the team so great that they might as well not be on campus?
Bill, the problem is that from the time they're 9 years old until they're into college, they're surrounded by adults who don't have their best interest at heart. These adults continue to tell them, focus on this, athletics, don't worry about academics, we'll take care of that, we'll take care of the grade. Derrick Rose, the star of the Chicago Bulls, Memphis had to vacate their entire season, including the national championship, because it was discovered that he had someone take his SAT for him.
Mm-hmm.
He took two exams, did miserable on it, and then took a third and got like a 1,200, which was a couple of hundred points above what he'd gotten. And this is the real tragedy of this system, is that there's the adults that are supposed to be looking out for these kids, and they're doing anything but. They're looking out for the bottom line.
Mark, before reading your book, I knew that lots of universities and colleges provided tutoring and other academic services for their athletes. I was not aware of how elaborate some of those programs are. Tell us about the one at Notre Dame.
Well, Notre Dame is actually the school that does it right. I mean, they do have serious academic standards for their athletes. They are expected to meet the same academic requirements as every other student. And Notre Dame is the only school in the country whose athletes have a higher graduation rate than their general student body. Now, it's by a couple of tenths of a point. It's 98.6 versus 98.4 or something like that. But they really began this system back in the 60s. They started deciding that, hey, these athletes are spending a lot of time at practices and traveling. We need to make sure that we're as committed to our academic mission with these kids as we are to the athletic mission.
But some of these colleges have whole study centers set up on campus only available to athletes. I mean, it's like you have to show your YMCA card or something to get through the door.
Well, they do, and that is part of the system. That's part of the special treatment that these athletes get. They get free tuition and room and board. They live in very nice dormitories that are quite often different from the dormitories that the other students live in. They have rec centers with Nintendo, and they sit at a special training table and eat special meals prepared by a dietitian. This is the world of the insulated world of college athletics that these kids live in. And again, this goes towards this facade of amateurism and protecting the business model, is because when a kid flunks out, then the school can say, well, we have this $10 million academic resource center, and it's not our fault, it's the kid's fault.
To what extent is the enthusiasm of fans from Southern Florida to USC and Michigan State to the University of Texas responsible for the corruption you describe?
The fan base really is what drives these media contracts that are just becoming astronomical. I mean, CBS is at the tail end of its March Madness contract. It paid $6.1 billion, that's with a B, for the rights to broadcast March Madness. Mack Brown, the football coach at Texas, just set a new record. He's the first coach ever to make $5 million a year. And here's the interesting thing, Bill. The money gets spent as fast as it comes in. Ohio State has one of the largest athletic budgets in the country, $110 million. 2 years ago, they turned a $1,700 profit, and that was an anomaly. It's this separate little world within the university system all its own, and it cannot be tamed.
A lot of these fans have a lot to say about whether coaches stay or go and how much they're paid. There were examples in your book of booster groups at universities saying, go ahead, fire this guy with 2 years left on his contract. We'll pick up the $2.5 million you owe him.
They certainly will do that. The example I cite in the book, a couple of examples, but one of them is the North Carolina State Wolfpack Club, one of the best organized alumni groups in the country. And they wanted a new college basketball coach, and they were willing to pay for it. And they committed upwards of $2 million a year to pay the coach's salary to get, quote, the right coach into that job and to make them national contenders again. The same thing goes on at other colleges and universities. North Carolina, their coaches' salaries are subsidized by their booster group. Phil Knight out at Oregon, he is perhaps the king of the boosters. He's given some $300 million to Oregon. He has a suite at the game in which he has a headset in which during the football games he can actually listen into the play calling from the booth down to the bench.
In your epilogue, you write that the issues of academic integrity, graduation rates, recruiting scandals, grade inflation, the facilities arms race, and overall influence of big money on college campuses are not getting better, they're getting worse. What led you to that conclusion?
Every year, the money seems to get bigger and more corrupting. And at this point in time, I don't think there's a better example than the State University of New York at Binghamton. It was one of the most respected state universities within that system. And then 4 or 5 years ago, they decided that they wanted to be competitive in college basketball. And they brought in a coach, an assistant coach from Georgetown to sort of make it into a top-line Division I program. And he started cutting corners. And Nancy Zimpfer at the SUNY Chancellor just finished her investigation and found blatant recruiting violations, including on the part of Lois DeFleur, who's the president of SUNY Binghamton and who was widely and properly lauded for creating a really fine academic campus. But she just lost sight of everything with this focus on D1 basketball. And that's going on at a school like SUNY Binghamton, which is as infected as any of the big-name schools that we see regularly at the bowl games or March Madness.
Mark Yost is the author of Varsity Green, a behind-the-scenes look at culture and corruption in college athletics, published by Stanford University Press. He joined me from WBEZ in Chicago. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
My conversation with Mark Yost about his new book, Varsity Green, will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with John Powers, who's been covering the Olympics in Vancouver. We'll have a story about the biathlon, and we'll be exploring several other aspects of the games, including who pays for them. Charlie Pierce will be joining me, of course, and we'll have a story about a New York hotel that's gone to the dogs and couldn't be happier about that development. A little joke I promise never to use again. So join us, and remember, you can always hear the program at onlyagame.org.